outside of the homepage under Community Events.
And stay tuned now, because coming up next is Health Watch. Today, Dr. David Naiman speaks with Dan Buettner, author of The Blue Zone Solution, which lays out a plan to maximize your health based on the practices of the world's healthiest people. And at 11:30, Will Hall hosts Madness Radio. That's voices and visions from outside mental health. And of course, we want to thank you for listening to KABU, and thank you, KABU members, for your generous support. If you're not a KABU member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. It is 11 a.m. and you are tuned to KBOO Portland. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market. From our hands to yours, celebrating 42 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday through Christmas Eve. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Dan Buettner, is the founder of Blue Zones, or an organization that helps Americans live longer and healthier lives. His groundbreaking work on longevity led to his 2005 National Geographic cover story, Secrets of Living Longer, and two national best-selling books, The Blue Zones and Thrive. Dan Buettner is here today on Health Watch talk about his latest book, The Blue Zone Solution, A Guide to Smart Eating and Lifestyle Practices, that's based on the habits of communities that have produced the largest number of long-living individuals. Welcome back to Health Watch, Dan Buettner.
Delight to be here.
So why don't we just orient our listeners who aren't familiar to your project, what you mean by the term Blue Zone?
It was a 10-year project with National Geographic that sought to find pockets around the world, populations where people either have the highest life expectancy, they produce the most centenarians, or they produce the lowest rate of chronic disease, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, et cetera. And then, in a sense, we reverse engineered longevity. We brought in then a second wave of experts who could tease out using scientific methodology what exactly is going on in these populations that is explaining an extra 10 years of life with a fifth the rate of chronic disease. And then The Blue Zone Solution is really a book that tries to put it in terms that Americans can actually follow.
So when you say you're looking for zones, either where people are living over the age of 100 at a higher incidence or a much lower incidence of chronic disease, do those two things correlate well? Do we see typically that where people have a higher percentage of survivors to 100 that they also have lower incidence of chronic disease?
Yeah, so there's two types of aging. The technical term is actually the buildup of cellular and molecular damage over time. And that would be lifting the ceiling of the lifespan of the human species, which right now is defined at 122 years and 4 months. Science is not even close to being able to do that. But what we can do is avoid the diseases that foreshorten our lives. So on average, Americans are living to about, life expectancy is about age 80. But really, if we could elude the diseases that we don't need to get, chronic diseases namely, we should be able to hit about age 92. And these Blue Zones, people are getting closest to healthy age 92 than any place else in the world.
And how did you go about sorting out what was causing what when you looked at these different communities? For instance, I mean, you have five Blue Zones, and some of them are very different culturally, like Okinawa and Sardinia are eating very different foods. How did you determine that it was mainly a nutrition issue versus, say, regular steam baths or genetics or some other thing that may not be around the way that they're eating?
Well, we start with the largely accepted assumption that only about 25%, and this comes from the Danish twin studies, only about 25% of how long a population lives is dictated by genes. That leaves 75% for lifestyle and environment. So we do put aside that there is a small genetic component. And then there are several factors. Blue Zone Solution really takes aim at food. I've been studying these populations for 10 years and trying to communicate it to Americans. And we tend to, the runway for a healthy lifestyle, or at least the entrance ramp for most Americans, is through their mouth. So Blue Zone Solution really focuses on the diet, what the longest lived people have been doing for the last, what they've been eating for the last 100 years. But to your point, there's 7 or 8 other facets to longevity that come, I think, after you've accepted the notion, yeah, I'm ready to make these small changes if living longer and feeling better at every decade is the value proposition.
So let's talk about some of the crossovers between the different Blue Zone communities. You have one in Greece and one in Italy and one in Japan, I believe one in California. What are some of the things you've learned that you feel like crossover from community to community around diet?
Well, first of all, they're all traditionally, on average, so worldwide for the last 100 years, about 90% on average of their dietary intake comes from plants or plant products. Very low processed plant. They eat a very high carb diet in all Blue Zones. About 65% of their caloric intake comes from things like whole wheat or oats or sweet potatoes. The cornerstone of every longevity diet in the world is beans. They're eating about a cup of beans a day as opposed to meat, cheese, or eggs. Well, they do eat some meat, but only about 5 times per month on average. So on all 5 of the Blue Zones, it has traditionally been a very low meat diet, you know, usually reserved for celebratory occasions.
And when you say meat, are you including seafood under meat, or is that another category into itself?
It's another category. So well, when I say meat, I mean terrestrial, like chicken, pork, beef,
right,
lamb, that sort of thing. They do eat some seafood, but not as much as you might think. On average, about 3 servings a week. According to the best data source in the United States, I believe, the Adventist Health Study, which followed 103,000 Adventists for more than 30 years. In America here, the people who come out on top are pescatarians, so people who are vegans and eat up to 1 serving of fish a day. But in reality, that average is more like 3 or 4 servings a week.
Well, it was interesting to see the differences when you see like a population in Okinawa, which I would guess probably is eating almost no dairy. And then in Sardinia, I think, or Greece, I think they're both eating quite a bit of dairy.
And none of the Blue Zones are they eating a lot of cow's dairy. They do eat some sheep cheese. You know, up in the highlands there of Sardinia, they were traditionally shepherds. And they make a type of cheese called pecorino. And that figured prominently into the diet the first 50 years of a centenarian's life. But metabolically, sheep cheese has a very different effect on the body than cow's cheese. And also because it's very rich, they tend to eat a lot less of it. So a serving might be the size of an ice cube, not 10 ounces melted on a pizza.
Right.
So, I think it's not only the kind of dairy, but also it's the low quantity it's important to pay attention to.
If, in case you just tuned in, we're talking today to author Dan Buettner about his latest book, The Blue Zone Solution, Eating and Living Like the World's Healthiest People. One of the more fascinating things about The Blue Zone Solution is your exploration of, can we take this information and can we translate it to an American reality in a way that would both be understandable and doable? And you look at, you ask the question, has it ever been done or has anybody ever tried to translate this before? And you start with a community in Finland in the 1970s. Can you talk a little bit about the relevance of that community?
Sure. So the cracking the code for longevity, or trying to find the central tenet of what makes people live longest, and it turns out there's no herb, there's no single food, there's no special diet, there's no exercise regimen. The reality is, no matter where you go and people live a long time, they are just simply products of their environment. So longevity happens to people. And about the time I was having this epiphany, I'd also gotten another grant from National Geographic to look at communities around the world who had bad health and reversed it. And there's only been one, according to the World Health Organization, one successful non-infectious disease community health project, and that's in North Karelia. And what they did, instead of trying to hound individuals to change their health behaviors, they gave them a little bit of education, but they mostly changed their surroundings. So they set up comprehensive and omnipresent nudges and defaults so that eating plant-based was easier. They were nudged into moving more. They built healthy social networks. So essentially made the healthy choice, not only the easy choice, but the unavoidable choice. And that was really the cue which we've since adopted to make Blue Zones here in America.
So the idea being less telling people that it's about willpower and more about trying to change the environment that people are functioning in each community.
Yeah, willpower and discipline, they're both great ideas, individual responsibility, great ideas. And you can sometimes get people whipped up and enthused, and they'll stick with their discipline and their willpower for a few months or maybe a year. But universally, and there's plenty of data on this, it is a long-term immutable failure. So when it comes to longevity, unless you're setting up an intervention for the long term, you might as well not waste your money. So you can change a city and make it more walkable. You can change food policies to favor fruits and vegetables over chips, fast foods. You can help people shape their, you know, their circle of friends so that their friends' idea of recreation is gardening or walking or playing tennis or eating plant-based. But it's really hard to make them remember a regimen and expect to stick to it for long enough to make a difference.
Well, before we start talking about some of the experiments that you've been involved in the United States to do community-wide change, the National Institute of Health did try some community changes in the U.S. that ended up not being successful. Can you talk about those and how that those informed your own projects?
Yes. In fact, I'm a good friend with the researcher who launched those. Well, there were six of them in Minnesota, Providence, Stanford. And they had the right idea. This was back in the 1970s. But again, they, for the most part, tried to get people to change their diet and remember a certain regimen. And in every case, you have kind of the health equivalent of the Hawthorne effect, that while the researchers were paying attention and cameras were rolling, people changed their behaviors. But when the researchers went home, people universally in those went back to their baseline. And the right-minded, just, you know, it took, you have to be willing to experiment, try, and I've had the benefit of learning what didn't work and build on that for this new wave of health, citywide health projects.
So tell us about the attempt to do a blue zone in Minnesota, which I believe was your initial project in the U.S.
Yeah, so 2009, we went in with kind of a menu, if you will, of a bundle of best practices, food policies, and built environment. How do you make your streets so they're built not just for cars but for humans? A whole list of checklists to go into every restaurant, grocery store, school, workplace to make that environment 15 or 20% more healthy, but for the long run. And then individual pledges. We got about 25% of the adult population to sign an individual pledge, which had them going into their kitchens to make permanent changes to their kitchen and deconveniencing their homes and making a new set of friends. And over the course of about 18 months, we were able to lower. So we were able to follow 25% of the population. In that 25% of the population, we brought their life expectancy up by 3.2 years. We helped them shed about 2 tons of weight. And most tellingly, we saw city workers' health care costs drop by about 40%. And that is what attracted the national attention that brought us to, now we're in 24 cities around America, including Fort Worth, Texas.
Could you talk about some examples of how you have to tailor the program differently based on the locale? Like, is there a big difference between the Minnesota project and the Iowa project or the Fort Worth project?
A useful metaphor is to think about a computer. What doesn't work is showing up with a set program and expecting a program to work among prairie dwellers and hipsters in L.A. and you know, cattlemen in Fort Worth. It's useful to think about an operating system. And our operating system simply says, what are the evidence-based ways to make permanent changes to this environment, to the ecosystem here? And my team has aggregated about 120 of them. And then we come into these towns, we'll make sure before we start that the city leaderships have all signed a pledge, the mayor, the superintendent of schools, the head of the chamber of commerce, et cetera, and that they're going to order off this menu. And you can't come in telling people what to do, especially conservative communities. But it turns out that almost all these communities, 70% of the people in them are obese or overweight, and they know that there's a urgent problem that hasn't been addressed. So if you bring them a menu of things that are politically palatable and affordable and that we can get done in 3 to 5 years, which is our average tenure in these cities, you'd be amazed at how much political will and how much you can get done. But you can't come in Bloomberg-esque and saying, you're going to do this. You're going to do 16-ounce sodas, whether you like it or not. That's always going to fail.
But it also seems like it's an accumulation of very small gestures becoming a large effect. Like even something as seemingly simple as changing what's in the coolers next to the cash register in a gas station convenience store.
Exactly. We think not silver bullet. That's what most people think. What's the silver bullet that's going to make the city? We think silver buckshot. So on any given community we work with, we're usually successful in implementing anywhere from 40 to 70 small things that move a population just a 0.5%. But if you have 30 or 40 of them moving in unison, we've been uniformly successful, and this is measured by Gallup, by the way, at lowering obesity rates and smoking rates by double digits in the teens. One in California, actually, in the beach cities, we lowered smoking by 30%. And that means millions or billions of dollars of savings over time when you're talking a population of several hundred thousand. So it's working, and it's got the economic rationale for communities to invest in it.
And if people are listening to the show and are interested in seeing about having the Blue Zone idea be considered by their city or their town, how do they do that?
Well, they can go to bluezones.com, our website, and part of the website is dedicated what are the longest-lived people doing, and then if they click on community, we profile these communities that are also really good. When a couple weeks ago, if you go to the Today NBC Nightly News and put in Blue Zone, they did a great profile of how we are Blue Zoning Fort Worth, Texas, and I think they did a really responsible job. And that's a good source as well.
Okay. Another really interesting part of the book that I loved was Blue Zoning the Home. And a lot of the commonalities between the different Blue Zones is they often have less convenient lives. And so one of the things that you suggest is not having a remote control, not having a garage door opener, not using power tools when you're outside, that all of these things are actually... not having all of these things will actually lead to a whole bunch of side benefits.
Right. Like anyone taken individually is kind of an eye roller. But when you add them all up, it gets you moving every 20 minutes or so because of the lack of convenience. Our great-grandparents burnt about 5 times as many calories in non-exercise physical activity because they didn't engineer the movement out of their lives like we have, you know, just kind of accidentally done unconsciously done over time. You know, we tend to think that the panacea for weight problems is, well, we'll join a gym. But there is no way that we can sit around in our offices in our home for 40 or 50 hours a week and then make up for it for 30 minutes 3 times a week at a gym. If you look at the physical activity patterns in these Blue Zones, these healthiest people, they're nudged into movement every 20 minutes. So they're jump-starting their metabolisms out of that hibernative state every 20 minutes by, they all have gardens. So one time every day they're out watering or weeding or hoeing. Every time they go to a friend's house or go out to eat or go to work, it occasions a walk. They're kneading bread by hand. They're in their yard, but they're using some hand tool rather than the motorized tool. So I'd be taking a hard look at our day-to-day activities and say, well, how can we engineer that physical activity back into our lives? So, a garage door, people typically go in their garage door twice a day. Get out of your car and actually have to pick it up. I actually think what the best thing we could all do is learn how to get to work or to our places that we go via public transportation. Interesting study that shows that people who take the bus to work walk 19 minutes every day. So that means, they're going from their house to the bus, and then the bus to their work, and then they do it in reverse at the end of the day, and have about 11% lower rate of heart disease. Now, that's a perfect example of engineering physical activity in your life, trying to make it so your kids are walking to school. We do this kind of false calculation that, well, if I let my kid walk to school, he might get snatched. But only 111 kids at USY get snatched a year, yet 250,000 of them are hurt or killed in automobile accidents. So, and 40% of them are running the risk of obesity. So it's a lot more dangerous to, pack them up in the car than to let them do as we did, which is strike off on their own and walk to school.
And then there's some other interesting facts you've learned in the dietary section. You mentioned earlier in the show that these communities are eating far less meat than the typical American community, and far more beans, and I believe far more nuts and plant-based foods in general. But you also noticed that a correlation with coffee and wine intake as being beneficial for longevity.
Exactly. Especially coffee, by the way. If you're not putting a bunch of cream and sugar in your coffee, coffee is a net positive, as long as it's not interfering with your sleep. Most of the time they're no longer drinking it after about 3 p.m. But it's a great source of antioxidants. People don't realize that. It's also associated with lower rates of diabetes and Parkinson's. So black coffee, teas, 6 glasses of water a day, and a couple glasses of wine, you're doing the right thing. You're stacking the deck in favor of longevity if those are the fluids you're drinking. Soda pops are almost completely unknown to people who are making it to 100. And
can you talk about what you call the rise and fall of Okinawa in relationship to the change in their diet and then the way the different health parameters have changed as a result?
Well, it's not just Okinawa. It's actually all the blue zones. And as the American food culture washes in, these dietary patterns that have incrementally innovated over the centuries or millennia are starting to disappear in the wake of, fast foods. Okinawa was particularly prone to it because the American food base has sat in the middle of the island since the 1940s, and it keeps very vibrant. What's popped up around them are the A&W root beer and the pizzas and burger joints, and they, for the face of it, they're great marketers. And when you're used to a diet that has low density foods, they're tasty, but they're not the napalm of flavor that you get when you put a bunch of fat, sugar. And people taste them, and it's like taking a dietary hit of crack. It's delicious. And then of course they start going back, and now in Okinawa, people over 70 are the longest lived people in the world, but people under about 65, they actually have the worst health of anybody else in all 42 of Japan's prefectures. So
wow,
we try to capture a moment in time. We captured a population that lived for 100 years, basically between 1905 or 1900 and 2005, and we studied that cohort. So we saw what did they do that we know, and we used demographers. This is National Geographic. It's very carefully done. What have they done to reach 100? And even though it's washing away because they're losing the habits that got them to where they were. They're losing the environment that got them to where they were.
You also briefly touch on the science around intermittent fasting and longevity. Is fasting something that you've seen across communities in the blue zones also?
Yes. So the Adventists, they eat a biblical diet, which means if you're a true Adventist, you're not eating meat and you're not eating fish without scales ever. Ecclesia, the Greek Orthodox, they're doing some sort of fast almost every other day, about half the days of the year, cutting out things like eggs and dairy products, meat some days, varies from place to place. So, Okinawa Nicoya, Costa Rica, they had forced famine. They had periods of time, years at a time, when they were effectively caloric restricted. So, again, what I do is I say, here's what the longest-lived people have done for the past century. Here's the health that it yielded. And the Blue Zone solution just tries to sum it up and let people draw their own conclusions. I like to stay away from telling people what to do, but I'll tell you what, there's a very compelling trend here that you see among people who have achieved the health outcomes that we'd like.
And your section in the book of recipes is a sort of bridge where I think people can take some of these ideas and translate them into actual meals here in America.
So what we try to do is identify the 50 or so foods that are most ubiquitous in Blue Zones that we see and also have a credible health claim to them, like tofu and sweet potatoes and nuts and beans, et cetera. And then we hired really great American chefs to take those ingredients and Americanize them, make sure they taste good. Because if I told you that broccoli will guarantee, if you eat 3 servings of broccoli a day, you'll live an extra 10 years, but you hate broccoli, you're probably not going to eat broccoli long enough to make a difference. So if we can take these Blue Zones, these superfoods, so to speak, and make them taste good, and you can afford it, your kitchen set up the right way so they're easy to make, you actually like it. Can you like it? Now, there's a system that can work for long enough to make a little difference in your life.
Well, it's great having you back on Health Watch today, Dan. Could you mention the website one more time for our listeners?
Yes. The book is Blue Zone Solution, and the website is bluezones.com. And you can, we're at Facebook at Blue Zones and Twitter at Blue Zones as well. And we have a very active social network, and we'd love for you to join.
Great. Thanks again for being on Health Watch today, Dan.
It was a blast. Live long.
You too. We've been talking today to the author, Dan Buettner, about his latest book, The Blue Zone Solution, Eating and Living Like the World's Healthiest People. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday Morning Radio Zine.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Copiosis Portland Tour. Capitalism Always Was Temporary, Saturday, May 9th at 4 p.m. at Tabor Space in Portland. Copiosis is a proposed socio-economic innovation that frees human civilization from debt-based economics, socio-economic domination, and government control. It proposes to eliminate all market externalities caused by traditional capitalism to spur innovation and to hold people accountable for their actions. Again, that's the Copiosis Portland Tour, Saturday, May 9th at 4 o'clock p.m. at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community. Hey, we said we don't want no capital.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is streaming, podcasting, and archived at madnessradio.net. Welcome to our new broadcast station, KBOO, in Portland, Oregon. Tuesday, July 13th, join Portland Hearing Voices for the Madness and Poetry Evening with prominent poets Emily Kendall Fry, Zachary Schomburg, and Sarah Guest, reading in a benefit for mental diversity. That's Tuesday, July 13th, 7 p.m. at the Someday Lounge in Portland. Donation is $10 and no one will be turned away for lack of funds. More info at www.portlandhearingvoices.net. Thanks for tuning in to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today we have UK clinical psychologist and psychiatric survivor Rufus May.